So it is now 8 o'clock, time for this morning's Dhamma talk. And as you often know, that you first come to a retreat, it takes a while to settle in, to find your way around, to get used to the place, for the place to get used to you, to have good rests, and to start feeling comfortable. And it's the same even with me, just coming here, just being able to, even I know the place, to really settle in and to get many loose ends finished and get some energy back up again. And especially last night I was very interested in some of the questions which were posed. And one of the reasons for having that opportunity to ask questions is not just to have those questions answered, but to guide me on what part of the Dhamma is really important to you, to help you with your understanding and also your meditation. And I often have noted that parts of Buddhism which people feel they understand, which they think they know, are the parts which we should always focus on more, because there's often things which we miss. And it was one old question, which was on the meaning of right effort, and that often comes up. And in fact, I do remember it was one of the questions which always bothered me as a young monk. And to understand exactly just how does right effort fit in to the rest of the path. I had experience of many other parts of Buddhism before I ordained in Theravada, and some of those were just really tough. Some were saying, no, just let it be. And it was a long time before you could find a resolution between what looked like a conflict. The teachings, the path was saying, just relax, let go, be peaceful. And another part of it says, strive, go for it. Sit down, meditate, as they used to say in those days, like your turban was on fire. Just sit down and say, even though my blood might dry up and my bones will turn to dust, I'm not going to get up for lunch unless I am fully enlightened. And I'm not sure about you, but especially if you're young, and maybe, I don't know, it's a male thing, but, you know, 'cause I don't know, I'm not a girl. But as a male thing, yeah, let's do it. You know, the tough guy, just a manly thing, let's just go and become enlightened. But even in those young days, I saw so much evidence which was counterproductive. I saw this was people who did put forth lots and lots of what we recognize as effort, only got very stressed and tight and angry at others. And it just started to make you look a little bit deeper into the teachings. And also reconcile those teachings, you know, which you read in the books, you know, with your experience. Because it was so true. Every time I put forth lots of efforts, all you did was get very tense and tight. And also you started to get frustrated. And when your effort didn't produce results, you started criticizing other people. Making too much noise, leave me alone. Sort of, you know, the food is not good enough, it's not suitable for me. So, you know, I need this type of food, I need this place to sit, I need this, I need that. Because that's what effort does, it controls things. And so then later on, when you started your practice, went naturally, sometimes in spite of your teacher and teachings. Your meditation sometimes, oh, what the heck, I'm just going to sit here. And you gave up your instructions, and a natural process of meditation started to unfold. The best meditations, as even a layperson, which I got, were always unexpected, unplanned, unwilled. They didn't come from striving. Been striving all the meditation retreat. And then I just gave up, let go, oh what the heck. And then amazing things happened. Now, this is not an advice to follow. But nevertheless, one of the great bhikkhuni arahats, a woman who just broke through to the Dhamma, and her tale always is amusing, but it's also profound at the same time. And when something has both those qualities, they're amusing, so you can remember it very easily, but there's a very powerful Dhamma sting in the tale, which really, wow, I understand where people go wrong. And that was the bhikkhuni who renounced and was a bhikkhuni for 7 years, according to her tale in the Terigata. 7 years. Now, I know that somebody else has bhikkhuni for 7 years. But this is something different. And for 7 years she was meditating and she was getting nowhere. She was just, after 7 years, imagine the frustration, having given up so much and, you know, done all the duties, kept her precepts, but still never really broke through to anything close to peace and freedom and not even a taste of Nibbana. And so after 7 years, she had this reflection. I'm getting nowhere. What's the point? So she did not want to go back to the three crooked things. And this was a metaphor in Pali at that time. The three crooked things. And the three crooked things was a symbol. Number one was the ladle for cooking, for making the curries. Now, this is crooked, I don't know, I've never, I suppose it is a little bit crooked. But he said, I don't want to go, first of all, to the first crooked thing, the ladle. In other words, to cooking for people. And number two, oh, Bianca's not here, is she? Oh, good. She's our main cook. And number two, I don't want to go back to the second crooked thing, which is was the floor brush. In other words, she had it up to here with housework. So I don't want to go back to the crooked ladle, the crooked broom, and the last thing she didn't want to go back to, the third crooked thing, was the husband. And that became known as the three crooked things in Buddhism. And that was the amusing part. So anyway, so I didn't want to disrobe and go back to the three crooked things. And so, only thing to do, and this is why I say this is not recommended, but this is what she did out of desperation. She went, took a rope, went to a tree, climbed up the tree, tied one end of the rope to the strong branch, the other one around her neck. She was about to commit suicide. And just before she jumped off, she got her first taste of freedom. Her mind was liberated. Another holy nun. Now that's cutting it fine. That is a dangerous thing to do. That is why it's not recommended. But the story was fascinating. She was one of these people who'd just given it everything, tried, put forth a will, and got so frustrated, which happens often when we think we can achieve through the sheer force of our will and our effort, and then we get frustrated. And the frustration often leads to desperation. And that desperation, in her case, got extreme. But why? Why was it that just at that last moment she broke through? She'd had all of the teachings. She knew everything about Dhamma, but she didn't really understand it and internalize it. The most important thing, letting go, abandoning, letting go of this effort which is coming from the idea of trying to attain something, trying to get something. Whenever she tried to get something, she'd always get frustrated. Now, even sometimes, okay, you know, you get nimittas, then you want the first jhana, then you want the second jhana, and then there's something more, and there's something more, there's something wrong there. There's always something more to achieve. And actually, those people who get those types of jhanas are not real jhanas. Real jhanas are totally different, they're just totally empty. It's a different experience totally than anything you can think of as attainments. It's one of the reasons why that some teachers have a little tick list. The five factors of first jhana. Oh yeah, tick that one, yeah, okay, now what else have I got to do next? And then tick this one, and then tick another one, and then say, oh, I've ticked all five, that must be first jhana, yay! That's so much gomayang. And if you don't know what gomayang means, I'll only say this once, gomayang. Go means bull, mayang means shit. Gomayang is bullshit. Okay, so I can now speak properly. And I've got that one clear. Gomayang. So, what is going on there? Why is it that we have something in the Eightfold Path called Sammavayama, sometimes Sammapadana? And what does that actually mean? And this is where one of the biggest problems with teaching the Dhamma is, you know, the Buddha never taught English, in English. You can't say the Buddha said that this is right effort. The Buddha never spoke in English. So these are translations. And like often, many things are lost in translation. So that was great, having had some experience in meditation, and also that when, this is personal story, when that I found that some of the rules which the monks had to keep as forest monks, and we tried to keep those as strictly as we possibly could, there was the case, what were the rules? And so it was just passed from teacher to disciple to teacher to disciple. It went on that way, and we wondered, are these the right rules we're supposed to be keeping? So that's why I was actually asked. So, you know, you've got a brain. You know, I got my O levels in Latin, and Pali is very similar structure to formal Latin. So let's learn some Pali, and let's start looking at these words. First of all, in the Vinaya, and then afterwards, in the Dhamma. So you could actually read it in the original and understand exactly what these words mean. And there was just so many eye-openers. Wow! That's what that means. A simple word, like anicca, which most Buddhists who come to meditation retreats know, anicca. What does that mean? And of course, besides, it's impermanence. Yeah, but what does that mean? When nothing lasts, what does that mean? So fortunately, you have these words. When you go to the monastic rules and the nuns' rules, these are describing events in real life, not philosophy or metaphysics. This is actually real life phenomena. And this particular word, anicca, it is obviously the opposite of Nietzsche. It's, you know, the A is just the opposites. So anicca and Nietzsche, they had something which we saw in the Vinaya, which we kept even today. It's called Nietzsche food. Nietzsche food means there are some people who I know will be at Bodhinyana Monastery today on a Saturday, because they come every Saturday, or maybe every other Saturday. There are people who come on Mondays to bring us dana. And a couple of them are here, but actually just use their family come. Obviously they're not going to be there next Monday. There are people who go on Tuesdays. You know, that even the Anagarikas over in Bodhinyana call it usually Thai Tuesday. because there's a lot of Thai people come over there on that day. So different people come on different days. So we call that, and this, I have to mention the Thai lady Noi and her family, Doi, and she's been feeding me for 36 years, once a week, hardly ever stops. And so it's amazing. That just brings me so much, wow, gratitude that these people have been looking after and serving regularly. And she comes every Wednesday. If she doesn't come, then, you know, there's something really wrong with her. Must be very sick or having an operation or something. So it's Nietzsche, regular. And the Anicca is the opposite. It's not regular. Something which you could always count on, something which was always there, now has vanished. It's much different than impermanence, which is one of the reasons why that when you tie this to your experience in meditation, it is like that you sit by the lake. No one's been sitting by the lake the last few days because it's been freezing cold and raining and wet. But it's a nice place to sit. You know, I think there's a bench out down there somewhere. And if you sit by that lake, yes, you can see the waves on the surface of that lake. You can see the water go up and down, up and down. That is not anicca. That always happens. That is just up and down, rise and fall. That is not anicca. What anicca is something far more profound and shocking. The Dhamma doesn't sort of reinforce things you already knew. It actually makes you see things in a totally different way. The sort of the wow, I never expected that to happen. So what anicca is you're sitting down there by the lake and you watch the waves go up and down, they rise, they fall, and then without any warning, the whole lake vanishes. And you're not going crazy. It was there for a moment ago and now it's gone. What the heck's happening? Something regular, something you could rely on. Something you thought was always going to be there, now is no longer there. And you're not going mad. This experience, I can say this experience from time being a layperson, I've got to be very careful about telling experiences since I've been a monk, because that's one of our other rules we're not supposed to divulge. And the reason we don't divulge any sort of strange, weird attainments is that because if you have psychic powers or attainments in the world, that separates you out from the others. And so the monks and nuns who don't have attainments, who don't have any deep meditations, they're like the riffraff. And the ones who do have attainments or can do things, deep meditations, they're called the Aryas. The Aryas, you know, the Arya Bhukhan, it means like those on the path to being enlightened, which means that we do have in, you know, Buddhism, we have the two classes, you know, they call Putuchanas, just the ordinary people, and the Aryas, which I call the Aryastocracy. It's supposed to be aristocracy, but I put the Y in there, Aryastocracy. And it does create a lot of problems, you know, for Buddhism, when you create a class of monks, nuns, lay people or something who are somehow superior than others. So anyway, that when I was a lay person, I was going to one of these Zen monasteries. And I'd go to any monastery simply because I didn't have choices. And so even now, in this monastery here, although in this retreat center, we just allow many different traditions to use the place as long as they keep the rules. Because I benefited from other traditions as well. And this was a Zen tradition. And the meditation instruction was something which I'd never done before. You had to sit down just on a bench with a passageway in between and sit on either side of the passageway, but we'd have to face away from the passageway and just look at the whitewashed wall. No windows. And just to make it more interesting, the master would actually just walk, you couldn't see him because, you know, you're facing the wall, behind you with the Zen stick. And just to make this talk interesting, I never got hit by the stick, the guy next to me did, and that was enough to keep me awake for the rest of the week. It was scary. But you don't have to worry about that, because when I was in Hong Kong, just gossiping, and that's how I was gossiping, just, you know, what's going on in the monastic world, because there was a Chinese monk, mainland China, and he told me that one Zen retreat there, the Zen master, the Chinese Zen master, was going down the hall looking at the meditators. There's one middle-aged woman, obviously, you know, quite well-to-do, because she was nodding, and so he whacked her with the Zen stick on the back. And so what was her response? I know the traditional response was, "Thank you, Master." But her response was to get out her mobile phone and call the police, which came within 5 minutes, and she charged that monk and they took him away. And that was the end of that retreat. And that was a true story. If it can happen, it does happen. You can't do that in today's, you know, Me Too world, you know, violence against people. So anyway, but putting that aside, just sitting there watching a whitewashed wall with your eyes open, and you wonder why? Because they didn't give you any instructions. Sometimes no instructions can be better, because then you don't wait for something to happen, not expecting anything. You're just being really an explorer, adventurer, now going into places you've never been before, not being told what to expect or where to go. And that was when you were watching that whitewashed wall, and it vanished. One of the weirdest things. It was there one moment, and then there was no wall at all. And most people might get scared. Am I going crazy, mad? Have they put something in the porridge that morning? You know, it was the late 60s, early 70s. You know, what was happening? And it was nothing which was drug-induced. It was a perfectly natural phenomena which illustrated anicca. Something which was there, which you thought was solid, that walls aren't supposed to suddenly disappear, did vanish. Simple, because your brain only notices things which change. It's only wired to notice things which alter. Sounds, background sounds, the taste of your saliva in your throat, which now you can feel, but soon will disappear. The feeling in your bottom sitting on the ground, after a while, if it doesn't change, it will vanish. All your senses are only wired to notice change, things which change. Which is why, if I looked at that whitewashed wall for long enough, without disturbing the continuity of my visual perception. In other words, I wasn't thinking. I wasn't trying to work things out. At least I had enough training to be able to watch that wall with a still mind. And then the wall disappeared. It wasn't important to my brain. It just turned off. And so you saw something which vanished. That is anicca. Things which are always there. Things which you take for granted, you can't even see, because it's always been there. When it gets to anicca, it vanishes, it disappears, like nothing you've seen ever before. So I went off a bit too far, too much on anicca, but this is with all the other factors of this Eightfold Path. Sometimes we think we understand, but sometimes we come to a place like this. We have some stillness, some peace, nothing much to do, and we see what happens. Things you don't expect is what teaches you the Dhamma. So we have to give all these teachings because that gets what we call like right view, the first part of this Eightfold Path. Because if you're not looking at the right place or you think, oh, walls vanish, I must be going crazy, call the ambulance, I'm out of here, then you don't stay long enough to actually to understand this is nothing wrong with this, this is right view. So what is the right view? Not just anicca, anatta. It's not yours. Nothing belongs to you. Not me, not mine, not a self. What does that mean? So first of all, not mine. Can you control anything in this life? What belongs to you? For me, things always go wrong. They don't happen the way I want them to. I really give a lot to trying to teach out of kindness. But sometimes your alarm clock goes off in the middle of the night and wakes you up and you can't go to sleep anymore, and so you're really tired. And then people want to talk to you. And then council officers come up and they want to talk to you. And then I said, I've got to go to get a rest, and he can't get a rest. Sometimes my life is totally out of control. And people say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you're getting old, you're not so the young spring chicken you were. Actually, I never was a young spring chicken. You should take more rest, take it easy. I can't. Well, you must. It's just not up to me. I'm out of control. You know, it's nice to know you're out of control. Because what that really means is that it gives the myth that you can steer your life this way or that way. You don't plan your life or steer it. You just respond to every little incident which happens in your day. You respond with, this is rushing ahead, with letting go, kindness and gentleness. But let's go back to the right view. The idea also, one of the best little descriptions, interesting takes on non-self, is that time when I pretend to be a visitor instead of an owner. You're the teacher. No, I'm not. It's Saturday today, so it's weekend. It's Easter. I'm having a day off. Can I have a day off, please? Okay, bye-bye. You won't let me, will you? It's not a day off. But the idea of pretending to be a visitor instead of an owner. Visitor to your house. Visitor to your car, or whatever you think you own in life. Being a visitor to your own body. It's not my body. I'm only visiting it. Okay, I'm visiting it for 70, 80, 90 years or whatever, but I don't own it. Just a visitor. That changes a lot of the way you react. So, in that metaphor, I go over to Jhana Grove. Oh, no, I'm in Jhana Grove, aren't I? Sort of. I go to Bodhinyana Monastery, and people ask me a question, and I say, sorry, I'm not the abbot today. Oh, but you're Ajahn Brahm. No, not today. I'm only visiting. I'm not the owner. And it's wonderful if you can do that. Pretend
you're somebody else. Or rather, you're not who you are. That's beautiful. Because say, who am I anyway? So that way, you can not own things. And it's so true. You know, those council officers who came on Thursday, one of the first things they say, oh, what a beautiful monastery this is. And they reminded me, I think, oh, crikey, thank you for reminding me how beautiful this monastery is. Because for me, it's my workplace. There's so many things to be done, so many monks to be taught, so many leaves to be swept, so many stuff. And I need reminding sometimes just how beautiful it is. You know what happens sometimes? Somebody shows you a picture, like a photograph. And I caught myself in it. I said, where's that? That's really nice. They said, that's Bodhinanda Monastery where you live. Oh, yeah, that's right. I can recognize it now. Because we see it from different ways. If you see it from an owner's perspective, you see it one way. A visitor's perspective, you see it totally differently. So that's why non-self, seeing things from non-self, it's not me, not mine, not a problem. That's one of my favorite mantras, which was brought up in the talks and the questions last night. Do you use mantras? One of my favorite mantras, which somebody taught me about 2 or 3 years ago, was Nanya. Nanya. Because apparently it came from this kid, and he told his mother, asked, have you cleaned your room yet? And he replied, Nanya. And she didn't know what it was. Have you done your homework? Nanya. Have you taken out the trash? Nanya. So she didn't know what that word meant until she apparently looked it up somewhere, and Nanya is short for none your business. And that's a very cute word to say to yourself. Am I enlightened? None of your business. Is this jhana? Nanya. Are you comfortable? Nanya. Let me say to him, I don't own anything. It's none of my business. Somebody else's business. So, how's your meditation going? Nanya. Now that is not meant to be rude or offensive. It's actually saying you don't own anything. So whose business is it? Are you healthy? Nanya. It's none of your business. You don't own this body. You don't own this mind. I don't own this retreat center. So it's none of my business. Imagine what it's like if you could actually live that, even just for half an hour. Sitting down here. This body, my practice. My practice? Whose practice is it? Why is everyone always practicing? Can't they ever actually finish their practice and actually do something? I shouldn't actually say do something, that's not what I really meant. But practicing, 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 practicing. Practicing makes perfect, does it? No, when you end practicing, then you get perfection. So anyway, the whole idea of trying to increase, develop, make something happen, get something which you haven't got, just to achieve, change, reach. Whenever you reach, it's called grasping. You're doing something. So, Nanya, not me, not mine, not a self. Who, what are you trying to get enlightened? When there's no one in there, that's all right for you, okay? There's no one in there, so who are you trying to get enlightened? What are you trying to improve? What are you going to own? That's why there was an old joke years ago. It's been a long time since I told this one. About the different vehicles. Big vehicle, small vehicle. All vehicles will be towed away at the owner's expense in life. Any vehicle, anything which you own, you will have to give up. Any attainment, any experience, anything which you own has to be abandoned sooner or later. As the Buddha said, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. But for many people that's scary. So when we have the idea of a non-self, not me, not mine, not a self, when we can actually start to let things, see things in that way, when we have that type of right view, where we have the idea, well, if there's no me, not mine, not a self, what is there? And this is the right view of, again, one of the really great teachings of the middle way. And there are two middle ways taught by the Buddha. I'm not just making this up. Mostly the middle way is the middle practice. But there's also the middle way between existence and non-existence. It is called cause and effect. A process. Not nothing, not a thing. A cause and effect process. And the best example of that is the simile of the candle flame. I use a candle flame rather than an oil lamp because not many people use oil lamps except in maybe Sri Lankan ceremonial days where we light the oil lamp. But the candle, many people know, especially beeswax candles. You just offer some beeswax candles, they're supposed to be healthier for you. But there was, what is the flame of the candle? Does the flame exist or does it not exist? What is the flame? And you all know, you have enough knowledge of science, but you don't take this knowledge deep enough. That the flame is only there because of three causes. The wick, the wax, and the heat. When those three are there, we have flame. When any one of those three is taken away, the wick, the wax is all used up. The wick is burnt through. Or the heat is removed, usually by going, that removes the heat. When any of those three causes is removed, the heat, the wick, or the wax, then the flame, what does the flame do? The word in Pali is nibbanas. So when you actually read that, hey, I know that word somewhere. It's one of the most important words in Buddhism, Nibbana, and it's past participle in the Buddhas. What does it say in the Ratana Sutta? Te kina bija avirudhi chanda Nibbana dira. It's going to Nibbana yatayang padipo, just like this lamp. So this is actually Nibbuta dira yatayang padipo. This is actually in the famous Ratana Sutta, which, you know, we chant on ceremonies. And this is where we see that when the wax goes out, it nibbanas. So when the flame disappears. So, I often say that Elton John was right. You are a flame in the wind. That's all you are. You're not going to sing it for me, are you? And it goes, disappears. Where does it go?
If the flame was a really good flame, you know, just lit the way for people and just warmed you up and cooked your porridge in the morning, if it's a really good flame, then maybe it deserves to go to heaven, to flicker happily ever after. And all bad flames go to hell. Which actually, when you see these drawings and paintings of the hell realms in Buddhism, they're full of flames, so most flames must be pretty bad. Of course, that's a lot of gomayang, because flames don't go anywhere. There are just three things come together, and then they're gone. That's you. Your mind, your jitta, your consciousness, your will, your knower. It's just a flame, which can go out. But a lot of times it keeps going and going, cause and effect, the middle way. Now you know who you are. You're just a flame. That didn't work. But, so once we have the right view, then that makes the path far more understandable. So if you have the illusion of a self, it's all right thinking that, but if you believe you have a self, then you will suffer. So, if what we do to actually to validate, you know, that understanding of the Four Noble Truths, when you want something, you create suffering. You just keep that flame. Wanting is the fuel. Keeps things going. The craving, tanha, and the upadana. This I'm doing dependent origination. Now, upadana does not mean grasping. It literally means taking up. It's one of those words which, you know, as it's termed, as you analyze it, actually that's what it means. Your car takes up petrol, or maybe gas, if it's on gas, or electricity, if it's a hybrid car. That's what the fuel it takes up to go forward. These lights take up electricity. That's what the fuel of it. And so these things take up fuel. That's upadana, what keeps, sustains it. Which give rise to the process of birth and the bhava and the rajati. So this is the fuel which comes up. And it all comes from this craving, this wanting. So what is striving and craving anyway? If it always comes from an illusion of a self and a will, that somehow you can do things. And that if you haven't got peace, freedom, happiness and joy, try harder. This is not what I teach, but this is just what many people say. If you haven't got enlightened yet, get up earlier. Stop being a lazy, good-for-nothing, just sleeping in your bed all the time. How many other people will try to get on this retreat and you're just sitting there just talking, having cups of tea, walking around, checking your iPhone and just eating in your rooms and just not really practicing, and you're stopping other people from getting in line because other people want to come on this retreat, you know. These retreats, they've been out on 2 minutes and they're all gone, and you come in here and you just waste people's time and, well, that's called guilt. That's got nothing to do. Guilt? That's all comes with a sense of self. Who's guilty? Years ago, I gave a talk about, you know, why I tell bad jokes. And I think it was Ajahn Sujato, I think. He actually gave it the title, Why Ajahn Brahm Tells Bad Jokes. And it was actually just basically a talk on dependent origination. Cause and effect. So it's nothing to do with me. I've just been conditioned. My father told bad jokes. So what do you expect? It's not me. I take no responsibility for the low quality of my humour. There's no one in here, no one to blame, so I don't mind. But anyway, should I tell this? Oh yeah, okay, I'll tell this one, because this just came today from a friend from Indonesia, and I thought it was really, it's a bit self-effacing. There's actually, how many, there's only two Brits in this, anyone from Brits who were born in Britain? Oh, you were, and I were. So it was, oh, over there, yeah. So three Brits, so please don't get upset, because I'm a Brit too. Somebody sent me this little video clip of, I think it was a Singaporean, by the sound of it, a comedian, who said, the British are a species. They can be compared to the intestines, and especially to the colon, because wherever they go, they turn it into shit, he was saying. And that's why they call it, you know, colonization. So that's right up my street. Okay, you can argue with it, but it's only a joke. And I was going to, actually, I put a woman part next time I get on the internet and reply to him, yes, I know, yes, but, you know, if you didn't have the colonial power or the colon power, then you get constipated. So thank goodness for the Brits. I can't control this. It's just my attitude, my cause and effect. So, all of your controlling. You know, one of the amazing things, you know, there are such things as arahats in this world, and sometimes when you actually meet some of these, they're not all what you expect to be an enlightened being. You know, sometimes you have a picture of an enlightened being. What an enlightened being should actually look like. Your fantasy. Someone like a Yoda, or I don't know. But can you imagine an enlightened being? Close your eyes and imagine one now. Is it male? Just see how you've been a cultural artist. And just stereotyping or whatever. But anyway, so when we actually learn what non-self is, we are just male, female, young, old. How do you know? Those are only the shell. And trying to sort of understand just what we are doing, or we try and even make our mind into a stereotyped enlightened being. I don't know what else you would draw in your mind, an image of an enlightened being, not just male. How many of you, if you saw, when you imagined an enlightened being, imagine it like an African? How many times do we just so gender stereotyped? How many of you can imagine an enlightened being? Because sometimes they don't tell who's enlightened, who's not. With this blonde back hair in a suit, living in the White House. Stereotyped. But, so, where we're actually going with this is that once we have this idea of right view, we understand we've created so many images
so many expectations, so many demands, so many ideas of what happiness is, what perfection is, what meditation is, what enlightenment is, which block us. And there comes a time, sooner hopefully than later, where you just sit here and you never let all of your learning and all of the dogma and in all of your training stand in the way of truth. You sit here, eyes open, better eyes closed, and just see the truth right now. Not adding, not subtracting, not wanting, no ill will, which is the hindrances. If there's anything you should be doing here, anything which is called right effort, it is whatever abandons these five hindrances and just keeps them at bay for a while. Those five hindrances which are wanting, especially wanting things of the five sense world, now, ill will, wanting is just, you just see, you hear what you want to hear. And you block out what you don't like hearing. You know, the wishful thinking and denial. That's why sometimes people come up and they say, oh, you know, I had a very, very peaceful, it was really still, and it was really joyful. It was first jhana, wasn't it, Ajahn Brahm? Wasn't it one of the things? Please, please tell me, please. I'll give you a big donation to your latest project. We don't do such things. Well, I actually saw this once. In my own eyes, this lady, she was with one of the really great monks who was an arahat. This was Ajahn Tate. And this Ajahn Tate, he was, she was being interviewed before me, so I was just listening. And he said, oh, I had this experience, and this experience, it was fourth jhana, wasn't it? I said, no, that's not fourth jhana. He said, oh, but you had this and this, I was very peaceful, very still. It was fourth jhana, wasn't it? He said, no. It went on like this for maybe 5 minutes, always asking, he said, no. And I think it more out of frustration or tiredness more than anything. She asked, but it was fourth jhana. That's what he said, And she went out with a big smile. Ajahn Tate has confirmed my Tate of fortune. She wanted it so much to be a Tate, to have it confirmed, that she wouldn't leave until, and Ajahn Tate can't lie, so she said, that was monk speak. So she heard what she wanted to hear. It's not what he said. So sometimes that you can see how there's five hindrances, wishful thinking and denial. You just can't see what is too hard to see. And yes, till this anecdote, one of the best, taught to me by Professor Bernard Carr, who's not only a close disciple, or was a close disciple of Stephen Hawking's, who's now passed away, but was also a very close friend. And he was, even last time I saw him, he was not only Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at Queen Mary College in London, but at the same time he held the post of Treasurer of the Psychic Research Society in London. A really professional ghost hunter. And he told me this great experiment which was done at Imperial College in London. I told many of you about this, but it just shows the power of denial. That this friend, now Bernard was implicated in this experiment, and he said he was going to demonstrate levitation in a laboratory situation. So they had the big, if you remember these old laboratories you may have seen in school years ago, they had the big bench and the sort of the layers or the lines of chairs and desks going up so the people in the back could actually see. And they had the video cameras
infrared cameras, everything to make sure if it worked, everyone can see. You could have evidence. And this person invited experimenter. He was a very well-known physicist, so he could actually ask his friends, well-known experimental physicists, trained observers, other scientists who knew how to observe, to come to this demonstration on levitation. And so once he came in with a flower pot, like one of these flower pots, and put it on the table to show there was no wires at all. And then he asked the whole audience. Now, I don't know if you remember your professors at school or science teachers, especially at university. These are just all just very conservative, bearded, tied, a little bit daggy maybe, but, you know, the old professors. And he asked all of them to chant Om loudly. And I'd have loved to have seen that. All these professors at universities just all chanting together, Om, Om, Om. You can imagine just like Mr. Trump and all his advisors sitting in the White House going, Om, Om, Om. Could you imagine that? This was even worse. Scientific, rationalist professors going, Om, Om, Om. And my goodness, as they were chanting Om, the flower pot lifted up from the desk. It levitated. And the cameras were whirring, the photographed, everyone was seeing it for posterity. They levitated a flower pot. And afterwards, when they asked those professors, a couple of them said, what are you talking about? It was on the table all the time. So look, you can see it. So that Photoshop, fake, didn't happen. And that was the whole purpose of the experiment. Because those of you who've heard this before know what really happened was underneath that big wooden desk, there was this enormous electromagnet. And whenever you turn on the sort of electricity to get that electromagnet to work, it's even more than when you turn on all the appliances in the kitchen and it flips the switch, which happens to be anchored every now and again. But this was a huge current. And you all know when you have a huge current, you have the hum of the electric current. And they had to chant Om to mask the turning on of the electricity. Otherwise, the game would be given away straight away. So Om, Om, it was nothing mystical. It was just to hide the fact a huge ampage had just been released into the electromagnet and the thing. But the whole point was, it couldn't happen. You can't levitate flower pots by chanting Om. That's why they couldn't see it. Look at that flower pot now. Om, Om, Om. Did it levitate? If it did, you wouldn't see it. Because you can't levitate flower pots. Your beliefs blocked experience. Your views are so powerful, they block bare attention. It's not bare attention. You filter into your mind what you want to see and feel and experience. Anything too challenging for you, leave it till later. Anything too repellent, you're not going to see that. How many people have tumours? Can't see them. It's too painful for you. Too threatening to your life. I don't get cancer. No, it's not cancer. and only notice it at the very end. It's a bit too late.
That's called denial, things which really challenge us, a bit too much. You don't see, you block it out.
It's not a tumour, it's just my nose.
So this is one of the reasons why that the job of this meditation is to overcome these five hindrances. There's only one way of doing that. Stillness. We don't see what we want to see. We're still enough, open enough to see what's there. And what you see, nothing to do with you. Final simile. The simile of the driverless bus. And I said this years before Google got the idea. Maybe some of you there when I did that. They got all these talks online or recorded somewhere. Oh yeah, I remember that. I was actually just... what year was that? I think I can actually date that. That was 1991 or 92. Simile of the driverless... Simile of the driverless bus. Simile of the driverless bus. We're here to try and get rid of our problems, to create some happiness, some peace, some meaning, some freedom in our world. And the simile is that you're like a bus. Your life's a journey. Your body, mind is on this journey. And you know what it's like? Sometimes in our life, we go through some terrible experiences. The loss of our loved ones, loss of our health, loss of our jobs, disappointments, old age, so many myriad parts of suffering. We can sort of expect it, but why? Somebody's made a mistake. It's when we blame somebody for our suffering, from our disappointments in life. Blame somebody. Yeah. And you try and blame other people, you can't. You realize, me, the one in charge in here, why is it that my suffering lasts too long? And why is it when you have some happiness in life, when life's going along really nice and peaceful, a nice meditation retreat, everything goes really, really well, and then what happens? I get sick. I've been looking forward to this for such a long time. And then you get sick and you can't stay here, you have to go. Oh, something happens. How many times do things happen when they shouldn't? It's a retreat. Why? So, you realize that you can't blame other people. This controller inside, what I call the will is stupid. So if I can only teach my will to be smart, to notice all the signs, to know actually when to put forth effort, when to restrain, when to develop good things, when to not develop good things. If I didn't get my will to be kind, give myself will, loving kindness and will, be smart, be wise, know all of the Dhamma. So if I can let my will be smart, then whatever I do, it'll be okay. So you try that, doesn't work. So after a while, all these methods of meditation, all these skillful means, when it all goes pear-shaped anyway, look at me, pear-shaped. But I'm certainly not carrot-shaped. But when things go wrong, so what do? Right. I'm going to find out this driver of my bus. That driver of my bus needs to be taught how to drive a bus instead of crashing and bumping all over the place and just speeding when I'm having a good time and just parking when I'm having a lot of suffering. Why can't that driver of my bus, the one in control of me, the real Ajahn Brahm, you know, the one who knows and does and just, why can't I tell this stupid driver how to drive a bus? So eventually you find out where the bus driver's seat is.
deep meditation, you go inside and inside and inside and inside. And you last find the bus driver's seat. Who's in charge of you? And when you get to the bus driver's seat, there you get a surprise. It's not what you expected, but it's too late to deny the truth. It's not what you want, but there it is. The bus driver's seat is... Oh, we're over time, so... Give the answer tomorrow. Thank you. No, I won't do that to you. The bus driver's seat is...
Empty.
There's no one there. You're out of control. There's no one driving your bus. So what do? You go back to your seat in the bus and you stop complaining. No one to complain to. End of problem. And that is the end. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Oh, very good. So, have a nice morning if you want to, but you don't have to. And we have interviews, and then we also have this afternoon special, 3 p.m. You still up to it? Yeah. Okay. Very good. Very good. Guided meditations.